morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Our revered ancestors were forced to fight a revolution against the colonial regime and the armies of its home country because they were refused adequate representation and respect. Because of their bloody insurrection, we, their descendants, have evolved more humane methods of deposing governmental officials who wield power selfishly and arbitrarily. The vote is a major process. It also allows us to better ourselves as well as our governance. Stripped of its fictions and fanfare, all democracy really does is give ordinary people a few tools to use against perfidious misuse of public office by special interests who wish to yoke a citizenry to their selfish and often brutal corruptions. And if these tools are not used, we the people lose the rights and liberties we do possess. Although disputing a president's authority is considered by partisans of authoritarian rule, such as Donald Trump, to be treasonous, it might be said that true treasonous behavior is to remain quiet and submissive to policies and abuses of authority that catastrophically imperil or undermine the basic principles of constitutional democracy. And now, by Robert Reich. Democrats are finally done with the high road and hitting Trump where it hurts. And he wrote this for The Guardian. I'm glad Democrats are finally hitting back at Trump. Enough with the high road. They are calling him weird. They are mocking him. Donald Trump fell asleep at his own trial, Hillary Clinton sneered at the Democratic convention. When he woke up, he had made his own kind of history, the first person to run for president with 34 felony convictions, quote unquote. Barack Obama noted Trump's weird obsession with crowd sizes. Michelle Obama asked, who's going to tell him that the job he is currently seeking might just be one of those black jobs? Trump hates to be laughed at. He cannot abide ridicule, so keep it up. But in addition to the mockery, we must not forget Trump's treachery. The values a president enunciates and demonstrates ricochet through society, strengthening or undermining the common good. George Washington's biographer, Douglas Southall Freeman, noted that by June 1775, when Congress appointed him to command the nation's army, Washington had already, quote, become a moral rallying post, unquote. In the 2016 presidential campaign, 240 years later, candidate Donald Trump's moral squalor was on full display. When accused of failing to pay his income taxes, he responded, "That makes me smart," quote unquote. He thereby signaled to millions of Americans that paying taxes in full is not an obligation of citizenship. Trump also boasted about giving money to politicians so they would do whatever he wanted. When they call, I give, he said. And you know what? When I need something from them 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me. In other words, it's perfectly okay for business leaders to pay off politicians, regardless of the effect on our democracy. After Trump launched an attack on NFL players who kneeled during the national anthem, Steve Kerr, coach of the NBA's Golden State Warriors, explained that the players were trying to protect a core American value. They are protesting excessive police violence and racial inequality, said Kerr. Those are really good things to fight against, and they are doing it in a nonviolent way, which is everything that Martin Luther King preached, right? And that's a quote. Before Trump, the peaceful transfer of power was assumed to be a central feature of American democracy. As the Harvard political scientist Archon Fung has noted, when losing candidates congratulate winners and deliver gracious concession speeches, they demonstrate their commitment to the democratic system over the result they fought to achieve, an important means of reaffirming the common good. Think of Al Gore's gracious concession speech to George W. Bush in 2000, after 5 weeks of a bitterly contested election, and just one day after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of Bush. I say to President-elect Bush that what remains of partisan rancor must now be put aside, and may God bless his stewardship of this country, Gore said. Let there be no doubt. While I strongly disagree with the court's decision, I accept it. And tonight, for the sake of our unity as a people and the strength of our democracy, I offer my concession. Consider what might have occurred had Gore bitterly accused Bush of winning fraudulently and blamed the 5 Republican appointees on the Supreme Court for siding with Bush for partisan reasons. Or if, during his campaign, Bush had promised to put Gore in jail for various alleged improprieties, and then, after he won, accused Gore of spying on him during the campaign and trying to use the FBI and CIA to bring his downfall. These statements, close to ones Trump actually made, might have imperiled the political stability of the nation. Instead, Gore made the same moral choice his predecessors made at the end of every previous American presidential election, and for the same reason. He understood that the peaceful transition of power confirmed the nation's commitment to the Constitution, which was far more important than his own loss. Trump has had no such qualms. When he lost, he embarked on a coup against the United States and instigated an assault on the U.S. Capitol, resulting in 5 deaths. At this moment, Trump and his lackeys are installing loyalists in state and county election offices to deny certification to the Harris-Walz ticket and other Democrats down the ballot. The essence of Trump's failure as president, and the fundamental reason he does not merit a second term, is not that he has behaved in childish and vindictive ways or is weird. It is that he sacrificed and continues to sacrifice the processes and institutions that undergird America to achieve his own selfish aims. He abused the trust we place in a president to preserve and protect the nation's capacity for self-government. Trump is a traitor. He and the Republican Party, now a personality cult based on Trump's big lie, and that's a quote, violate everything America stands for. And that was by Robert Reich, who was a former U.S. Secretary of Labor. He is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, and the Common Good. His newest book, The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It, is out now. He is a U.S. columnist and a columnist for The Guardian. And now, I wish to take issue with the use of the term veteran that is being ballyhooed around in this campaign. A veteran is a military survivor of a war. No one else is a veteran. The current tiff between two vice presidential candidates about which of them was a bona fide military veteran is a bogus travesty. Although each of them apparently served in a military capacity, neither of them participated in combat, which renders their public name-calling of each other a ludicrous affair. The most legitimate meaning of a military veteran is one who served and survived wartime combat. Any other derivation of the word is incorrect, despite contemporary usage. That means that every person who served in a military service during peacetime or did not directly experience combat during a war are not truly veterans. That distinction applies only to wartime combat veterans. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. 52 years ago today, on August 29, 1972, a small fishing boat capsized in the Columbia River Bar. I was aboard that vessel, the Meteor, home-ported in Astoria. Our crew of four was rescued by other boats whose crews risked their own lives and vessels to save us. Many thousands of river and ocean craft have capsized in or near the Columbia River Bar, known worldwide as the Graveyard of the Pacific, and nearly 1,000 and perhaps more have lost their lives in the past 2 centuries. No records exist of the losses of Native mariners who crossed the bar for thousands of years. And now, something else I wrote. Trees are us. And I start with a quote by Jack Oman. Forrest Gump. A forest is like a box of chocolates. You eat it all up. Less than 10% of old-growth timber remains in the Pacific Northwest, which includes Northern California as well as Washington and Oregon in the United States and British Columbia in Canada. Though the forests of British Columbia are intensely logged, they are not within U.S. jurisdiction, even though a vital part of the ecosystem under discussion. The economy of the Northwest is largely based on timber products and has been assailed with court injunctions against clear-cutting public forests, despite a badly compromised and unpopular plan the Clinton administration attempted to put in place as an aftermath of a well-publicized forestry conference in Portland. The problems and complexity pertaining to forest use focus on employment, endangered species, shrinking habitat, land erosion, and water pollution. Disastrous fires that consume hundreds of thousands of acres each season and kill animals and firefighters. Climate change, methods and extent of logging, especially clear-cutting of remaining old-growth forests. Access and use of public forest lands. We read and hear about the massive destruction of the rainforests of Asia and South America, yet somehow we find it difficult to equate with our own clear-cutting of forests in this country. The great North American forest has virtually disappeared in little more than 2 centuries, from the East Coast to the Pacific Ocean, from the great conifer forests of the North to the hardwoods of the South, in particular, a huge swath across the top of the nation from Maine to Oregon. Little is left of Oregon's old forests and the forests of Northern California and Washington, and what little remains is incessantly under threat. The never-quenched hunger of the timber industry has butchered its own lands, replacing them, when they do, with inferior and less profitable monocultural tree farms. Incredibly, the timber companies demand as their divine right the public forests, and as they log off more and more public timber, they demand more of what is left. The city of Astoria is a microcosm of the same situation, trees versus money, the long-range loss of a local ecosystem in exchange for short-term profit. Astoria is unusual in that it has a large city forest, which most cities lack and many wish to have. This small remnant of a much larger forest on the hills above the Columbia River is instrumental to the quality of life many wish for themselves and their successors. Others do not share sympathy with that vision. Trees are economical units to them, to be harvested to meet market demands without consideration for aesthetic or ecological value. The Pacific Northwest is in the same shape as Astoria. Its resources have been ravaged, and the greed for what remains will not end until all of it is gone. Trees, fish, and everything else despoiled for single generation profit, one generation succeeding another in its desire to exploit whatever is available for sale. Yet the glory days of logging are at an end, which leaves a simple dramatic choice: to either allow loggers to keep their jobs until they have cut down the remaining old-growth forests, or save what is left at the cost of jobs they will lose anyway when the last trees are down. Automation and export of raw trees have accounted for the loss of most timber jobs, contrary to claims by the timber industry. Timber companies and environmentalists push at each other with little inclination to compromise their positions. Stubborn environmentalists make good ancestors. Loggers do not. They have denuded the forests and showed little inclination to replace what was lost on their own lands, instead demanding a mandate of public forests for their chainsaws. And here is a paradox. Not among managers who see trees as only ciphers on ledgers, but in the attitude of proud, roughneck loggers who consider themselves woodsmen and profess love for the forest they destroy and refuse to quit cutting until nothing is left. When the last of the big trees are gone and the poor grade second and third growth timber reduce profits, the managers will diversify their portfolios and dismiss the woodsmen who created their wealth. Let them be dishwashers. Without the forests of Asia and the Americas, we bequeath our descendants an arid world, a hot greenhouse. No shade to shield us from the sun's ultraviolet rays. We have virtually ruined upper atmosphere ozone. Water systems dry up without the cooler, moist climates of forests. Biological diversity disappears. Marine life vanishes. Maybe only hallucinogenic drugs will recall the ancient symbiosis with Earth before our species moved out alone to dominate our home planet through obliteration of all that makes it home. And now, a couple of poems from my niece, Tracy McCusker. Man of science. Man of science, tear away sentiment. This veil, brutal vigor, is much admired in your indolence. You have accomplished wonders, put into shade all exoduses, all ancient venerables swept into your conditions, profane connections over the whole surface. Daily, you have been or are being destroyed. There is no life or death, only raw material and remotest zones. Coda. A single weapon is supremacy. The fight immediately bound to this prelude. In short, move against the order of things. The disdain to conceal their aims openly declares force. The ruling have nothing to lose. They win all. And now another one from Tracy McCusker. So desperately have I wanted to believe that you and I shared a bond greater than words or pleasantries. I called your name in dreams and waited then the next for a ghostly response, a token of love, long delayed, anticipated. Too true, I detested your hands, your manner, your grace. I abhorred your lips, your kisses, your indifferent face. My hatred was far greater, and I reached to you with this. Still was my call unanswered, alone, unwary, remiss. What bond, then, could we share? I feel it when your name is spoke, buried beneath the apathy. I read it in my small diary of hope, buried beneath the curses. With all passed between, now I call in kinder dreams, embracing the divide. I call your name and send my soul, but when it crashes, falls, light laughter echoes far and wide. And after the Sylmar fire, the car passes motley storm swans in the mortuary pond, preening. The white braces on the foothills aren't thunderheads. Wet plumes rise. Stricken, you pull to the shoulder. The air is thick. The flashpoints are box scars on the black hills. The ground, a painter's drop cloth, where noxious fingers stoop to stir the ash, rises like mad fleas. The white skirt conceals our lacework city. The blushing paved veins, the supple, are of the highway, our bulwark, broken-legged. There is no dew song this morning. It is the season of flying south, of tight lips and moving past.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.